Thanks for tuning in to Aspen Public Radio. I'm Allison Bektesh. In just a moment, we will hear a roundtable discussion on the fate of our public lands with editors of High Country News, with an introduction by Aspen Public Radio News Director Carolyn Zachariasen. Stay tuned.
Live broadcast of High Country News, The Fate of Public Lands, Roundtable Discussion at the Rocky Mountain Institute in Salt. I'm Carolyn Zachariasen, the news director at Aspen Public Radio. Our moderator is Brian Calvert, managing editor of High Country News. For the next 40 minutes or so, he will discuss with the panelists what the Sagebrush Rebellion means for the future of the West. After their lively discussion, we will then take audience questions. I'm now going to turn it over to Brian to introduce the panelists.
My name is Brian Calvert. I'm the managing editor of High Country News. Tonight we're going to discuss the fate of our public lands, which are those wild spaces dear to the American West. We're going to do that with some of the magazine's writers and editors here. I'm going to introduce them in a minute, but first I want to thank some of our sponsors. So thank you to the BF Foundation, to Conundrum Catering, to Wilderness Workshop, to Fish Trap, Colorado Wild Public Lands, Element, and the Sopra Sun and New Belgium Brewery. So thanks to our sponsors. And thanks for everyone being here. So as many of you know, High Country News is a nonprofit magazine. We publish 22 issues a year. We maintain a daily website. We cover issues that are important to the American West. One of those core issues is public land. We've been doing that kind of coverage for 45 years. Public lands are what you think of when you think of the American West. You think of national parks, you think of wilderness, wildlife refuges, national forests, and the big swaths of territory that no one used to love but everyone loves now that are under the management of the BLM, the Bureau of Land Management, all these wide open spaces. These public lands contain a lot of different resources. That can mean timber, gold, oil, natural gas, coal, or even big game. But that can also mean solitude, beauty, rare species, or even wildness itself. So it's not surprising that the public lands are a pretty contentious place. Anyone who lives in the West will agree that it's a great resource, but the problem is we don't always agree on what those resources are or how we should use them together. So there are a lot of different threats to the public land we could talk about for a long time, from climate change to development. But what we really want to talk about tonight is a different sort of political aspect that is a different kind of attack on the public lands. That's a movement to have either land transferred to the states from the federal government, or sometimes that gets intertwined with a more anti-federal sentiment or movements. The most obvious movement there was in January, you had a group of armed militants occupied the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge in Oregon. That was an example of this sort of anti-federal sentiment mixing around with armed groups with different sort of factions and agendas, but really kind of landing right in the public land sphere and right into some of these questions of who the public land belongs to and what they should be used for. So we've seen some of this happening across the West. High Country News has been investigating different aspects of it. You can read a lot about it on our website, which is hcn.org. You can kind of follow along there if you want to. So that's what we're going to talk about tonight, are these groups and what are happening with these groups, what the history of these groups are, and what they mean potentially for the future of public lands. I'm going to do that with the help of panelists that you see before you. Senior editor Jody Peterson is here, senior editor Jonathan Thompson, and our Washington, D.C. correspondent Elizabeth Shogren. So thank you guys for being here. I think we'll open it just with the idea of what is called the Sagebrush Rebellion, which is the sort of larger tag that was given to these kinds of groups and this kind of movement back into the 70s. So I mean, maybe Jonathan Thompson, why don't you sort of start us off, and maybe you can describe to us what the Sagebrush Rebellion is and where it came from.
Sure, Brad, thank you. Welcome everybody. So I won't start way back in for the Sagebrush Rebellion, which really has its roots well over a century ago, but I'll start with the first modern Sagebrush Rebellion, which was in the 70s. That each one of these kind of waves of rebellion is a reactionary thing. It comes about because of something else that came about it in reaction to something else. So the first one really was sparked, I think, by FLPMA, which was the Federal Land Policy Management Act, you know, one of these terrible acronyms, which did a number of things, but one of the big things it did was, you know, it told the BLM, you're not going to be the Bureau of Logging and Mining anymore, but you're going to be managing for multiple use. And also, probably more significantly, is you're not going to dispose of land anymore. So no more of this giving a bunch of land away to the railroads like happened in the early West. No more homesteading, no more patenting of mining claims. There would still be mining claims, of course, but you know, you're not going to just give this land away anymore. Basically, what's federal land now is going to stay federal land, and these federal agencies are going to manage it. And that really upset a lot of people during a time that a lot of the extractive industries were running up against bigger market forces anyway. So they were having problems with, you know, the globalization was coming along. A lot of the mines were shutting down anyway because they were being outsourced to Chile and places like that. And so there was a lot of angst in the rural West. And these new policies that came about, you know, and FLPMA was after, it followed the Endangered Species Act, it followed the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, all the stuff that happened in the early 70s, the creation of the EPA. So there's a lot of stuff going on that a lot of rural Westerners felt threatened by. And so the first Sagebrush Rebellion really kind of grew out of the hot spots were Utah and Nevada, and it was, the main players were usually politicians of some sort, local politicians. They were county commissioners. The big one that a lot of people have probably heard of is Cal Black, who is in San Juan County, Utah. And he is the model for Bishop Love in Edward Abbey's Monkey Wrench Gang. Very thinly veiled model. And he was a uranium miner and a county commissioner, a state legislator, and a businessman. And he was, you know, he was adamant about this idea that he saw the federal government as a landlord and as an absentee landlord and as a very bad one. He talked about colonialism and he talked about imperialism and that sort of language. And he was joined by a lot of other people, including Orrin Hatch, who is still around. A lot of those guys got together. They created a group called LASER, which is another crazy acronym, has to do with state rights. And they started a land transfer movement. They wanted to transfer federal lands to the states, just like we're seeing today. Then in 1980, Ronald Reagan was elected, and those guys sort of had nothing else to rebel against all of a sudden, because Ronald Reagan appointed James Watt, who himself was basically a sagebrush rebel, as Secretary of Interior. And also, you know, I think that by then the movement was beginning to see that the ranchers and the miners and the kind of little guy on the land was beginning to see that maybe it wasn't such a great idea to transfer these lands to the states, because typically the states charge more for mining royalties, they charge more for grazing. And oftentimes they end up selling off to corporations. So if this land that they were grazing, you know, very cheaply suddenly became state or private, they would lose access. So I think a combination of things kind of came together. Also, they lost some court cases, the Sagebrush Rebels did. And so they began to realize, you know, maybe they don't really have any legal grounding in this idea that the states are supposed to own this land. So that kind of faded away in most places, although there were still localized kind of things going on. But then again in the 90s, you know, Bill Clinton was elected. He brings in Bruce Babbitt as his Secretary of Interior. They talk about grazing reform. They start making national monuments. And again, you get another uprising. And at that point, it was a little bit more intense, I think, than the first one, because at the same time there was a Patriot movement, what they called the Patriot movement, which was just a more general anti-federal kind of somewhat violent movement that didn't necessarily care about land rights, but because it was in parallel with the Sagebrush Rebellion, they kind of got some synergy going. And you know, that ended up becoming, you had events like Waco and Ruby Ridge in Idaho, where there were shootings and standoffs with federal agents. And that really kind of fired people up. But that also faded away when we got George W. Bush in office, who himself was sort of a Sagebrush Rebel, as was most of his cabinet, including Gail Norton, who was a kind of a disciple of James Watt. And so that kind of leads up finally to, in 2008, President Obama was elected. You know, and he wasn't necessarily, he didn't come into office saying, you know, we're going to make huge reforms with environmental laws or with public land or anything like that. But the fact is that conservatives, rural Westerners, you know, basically a lot of people just didn't like Obama and reacted pretty strongly to him. Of course, we had the Tea Party rising up from the election of Obama. And that group, you know, at the same time, you did start having more of the Sagebrush Rebels coming up as well. And then you had this real merging of groups, I think, you know, more than ever so before, where the Sagebrush Rebels and all these other groups, these militia groups, these Tea Partiers, sovereign citizens, and all these guys started really overlapping, and it kind of culminated, I think, in January, well, in 2014 at the Bundy Ranch, but then more so in January at Malheur Wildlife Refuge.
So Jonathan is our senior editor and in-house historian, and it's always very helpful to have him. I forgot us even parts of those already. It's good to be reminded. So sort of what we saw is, this ebb and flow, it still kind of simmers. But then there was, you know, at High Country News, we're kind of watching that kind of thing happen. But then we also started to see something that wasn't quite similar yet, or it was more of a legislative thing inside of a land transfer movement. And maybe Jody, you could speak to sort of what we've been watching in terms of the land transfer movement outside of the sort of rebellion and the militant.
Thank you all for coming. I appreciate you being here and welcome. And yeah, when we're talking about the different kind of roots that we see kind of forming this attempt to try to take over federal lands and get them quote unquote returned to states. That's the imminent federal land takeover alert. this movement has often been kind of painted as a grassroots movement, and there definitely is a very strong grassroots component. A lot of Westerners who are unhappy with the way that federal lands are managed, you know, they see their local forests maybe, you know, experiencing forest fires, or they feel like their access is restricted. They feel like there's, you know, ranchers maybe don't have as much grazing access as they used to. So there's that kind of current of unhappiness about federal land management, but that's then encouraged at a higher level by politicians and kind of this sort of this effort to foment things at a higher level that kind of can be traced back to a couple of higher level organizations. There's the American Legislative Exchange Council, which is a corporate funded group that basically supplies a lot of counties and states with language that they can use in legislation that they want to push towards getting federal land transfers. So there's that, you know, corporate motivation kind of behind a lot of the land transfer movement. You know, there's very much of an effort by corporations and, you know, business interests to get more access to public lands because there are a lot of resources there that they would like to get access to. And, you know, the federal government certainly allows a lot of development, a lot of oil and gas, a lot of mining, a lot of grazing, but there's a sense, I think, that if states controlled land, access would be even easier. There would be fewer environmental restrictions to comply with. There would be, you know, more ability to develop all the natural resources of these vast western lands. And so you have these higher efforts kind of trying to, you know, push along that dissatisfaction at the grassroots level. And you have, you know, Utah Representative Ken Ivory, who runs something called the American Lands Council, and that's, you know, also kind of a front group that pushes these efforts forward. And the Americans for Prosperity is another one. But all of those efforts, it seems like that a lot of the people involved at the grassroots level is kind of see it as more of an issue of personal liberty and being trampled on by the federal government, and seem to believe that if lands were transferred to states that they'd actually have more access and that they wouldn't be so restricted by the federal government. But what seems to get lost sometimes is the fact that if lands actually did go back to states, there would probably be much less public access than there is now. There would probably be, economically, there'd be much more pressure from states to make money off those lands and to open them up more for development and to lease them. And so the people who kind of imagine that they would get unfettered access to public lands would probably find that there actually has a lot less access.
Yeah, and time is flying here, right?
Yes.
I think what we'll try to do is we'll keep this pretty tight to see kind of where things are going, and we might wrap up our discussion here and then open it up for a lot of questions and answers. So we're going to make a pretty big question and answer session. We can talk more on that. So because we do have listeners listening live here, so we're going to kind of be inside of that time frame. But so I think, you know, it's important to remember that we have a lot. There's a lot of movement happening in this kind of thing, but there have also been some political costs. And so Elizabeth, maybe you could talk a little bit about what sort of some of the political costs are, and maybe talk a little bit about what the challenges are to the federal government as they try to manage these lands in the face of some of this opposition or sentiment.
Well, excuse me, one of the big political costs of this, I think, is a stalemate that happens here in the West and also in Washington, D.C., where I live, because there's not a consensus around this kind of land transfer idea. And so there's not a lot of movement on policy that might go in one direction or another. In fact, it becomes a kind of a stalemate. And I think that that's one of the biggest things that happens. And it can be a stalemate on the big level, as far as not passing new laws like redoing, say, the 1872 Mining Act that might want to be updated just a little bit. But because nobody can get together around a new idea for public lands in a kind of a national fashion. And I think that that's a big that's a big problem with, I mean, that's a big consequence. And another, but this, the consequences can be small too. I was just looking through some responses that we got to a Freedom of Information Act request about a less popular or a less well-known incident of the Sagebrush Rebellion, which happened in the spring of 2015 in Oregon. It was around a mine called the Sugar Pine, and in that case, a group called the Oath Keepers, right? I'm sorry, I flew all the way from Washington today. My head's not completely here yet. The Oath Keepers came in, armed group, to try to get to protect the miners, in this case, from the BLM. The BLM didn't think they really needed to be protected from, and it was interesting reading through these, what we saw were some emails between BLM officials where they were talking about what to do about this incident. And one of the things they were saying was they were canceling all these other things that they had planned to do, including timber sales. They were pushing those off because they didn't have time to do that because they were spending all of their personnel was dedicated to this uprising. And the other example that I thought was really interesting in the FOIA reports that I was reading through had to do with one employee of the BLM who was supposed to go to a resource management plan meeting to meet with the public. And she thought there would be Oath Keepers there. And she didn't go, and she sent her boss. She was the one who was supposed to be talking about recreation, and she sent her boss a note and said, "You know, I just don't feel safe. I don't want to do my job." And not if that sounds more negative than I mean it to be, but I can't do my job. It doesn't feel safe to me. And I think that those are just little cameos of what happens as a result.
Yeah, I think sort of what we've seen is, a little bit more armed expression of this anti-federal sentiment. At High Country News, we've also done some investigation into just how federal employees are treated at their jobs, and we did a lot of Freedom of Information Act requests, and maybe some of you remember this series. It was in 2014, and we really pushed the agencies to let us know or release to us their reports, their incident reports, basically. And what we got from that is a kind of surprisingly high number of threats to public land employees. So when a federal employee says that she doesn't feel safe to do her job or that she can't do her job effectively, we know concretely that that's happening across the West, that people are getting, there's just, I think it's a part of a deeper culture war that's sort of driven by this Sagebrush Rebellion and anti-federal sentiment. It sort of has kicked up again under the Obama administration, and it's pretty difficult for people to do their jobs when people don't want them there. And we know that some federal lands agencies employees are encouraged not to wear their uniforms, for example, when they're patrolling. So, and these kind of incidences kick up often. And now we're kind of seeing they're feeding other debates. I thought maybe we would talk a little bit about Bears Ears, which is an area of southern Utah that is up for, likely to be declared a monument. But this is sort of in the heartland of the sort of beginnings of the Sagebrush Rebellion. So Jonathan, maybe you could talk a little bit about Bears Ears.
Sure, yeah, and so Bears Ears is, it's actually a topographical, it's two buttes in southern Utah right above what's called Cedar Mesa. And it's very archaeological rich area. It's beautiful. It's canyons and mesas and that sort of thing. And it's also in San Juan County, Utah, which I was talking about earlier with Cal Black. And now sort of Cal Black's descendant is Phil Lyman, who led an illegal ATV ride through Recapture Canyon in protest of federal overreach. One of the interesting things there is that both Cal Black and Phil Lyman, they're protesting federal overreach in general, but both of them targeted, or, you know, they both focused on a certain thing. In 1986, there was a raid. The federal government came in and raided the town of Blanding, basically, a bunch of people for pot hunting or looting archaeological sites. That was one of the big drivers, including Cal Black's house, in fact. And then in 2009, there was another very similar raid. You know, it's about 120 federal agents, I think, came in. And they had guns and flak jackets and all that stuff. And they raided these homes. A lot of very prominent citizens in town, including a doctor, the town doctor, who was very much admired. And the next day, the town doctor killed himself. And both of them focused on these things. And to me, that's interesting because that's really the issue behind Bears Ears. Is, you know, of course, there's oil and gas drilling, and there's a lot of other things that could threaten it. But I think the biggest threat in most people's mind in that area is pot hunting. Mostly because it is actually sort of a local hobby. You know, some people go out on picnics, for 4th of July or whatever. And quite frankly, in San Juan County, it's long been a tradition to go out and pick up pot sherds or pick up artifacts or even dig. So now you've got this Bears Ears Monument proposal, and a big driver behind it is that people want more resources there to protect the archaeological resources. And yet it's in this tinderbox where, you know, I mean, this is gonna be a big conflict, I think, if it does get designated. But at the same time, you know, it's like, this is a place where really it probably does need to be protected. And right now what you have, the big driver lately has been in the last year or so, five Indian tribes have come together and they have, the tribal governments themselves have said, we want this to be a monument. And they have gone to Washington, they have lobbied very hard to get Obama to designate this and to actually create a management structure that has those five representatives from those five tribes on a panel that manages this park, along with the three relevant federal agencies, the Park Service, BLM, and Forest Service. So the tribes actually have a lot of control here. And so it's a really interesting dynamic. It'll be interesting to see how it plays out. But it could get ugly as well.
This is Aspen Public Radio broadcasting on KAJX Aspen and KCJX Carbondale. I'm Allison Bechtesh. You're listening to a live broadcast of The Fate of Our Public Lands, a panel discussion with editors from High Country News at the Rocky Mountain Institute in Basalt.
You know, are there actual legal ramifications to this movement? And maybe I'll ask this to Elizabeth because, is it possible that federal lands could be transferred out of the federal government? What would that entail? What would that even look like? Because that would frankly change the face of the American West.
Well, I think that the federal government does have the power to transfer its lands, but that would take Congress voting for that to happen. And so far, at least, there have been people who've stood up against that. And there haven't been enough people who want that to happen. And it's hard for me to see how the next Congress would take a shape that would approve such a thing. I don't think it's likely. I think we're more likely to have the kind of Congress that we have now, which is one that's often at loggerheads and fairly rarely ever does anything as far as passing legislation. Every once in a while, they do pass legislation, and they recently passed a very major environmental bill that has to do with controlling toxic substances. So that was kind of stunning. And Senator Tom Udall from New Mexico was the one who really made that happen. And that was kind of amazing to see happen you would think in Washington, having bills passed would be something that you'd see happen all the time, but not so much. And so that's one thing. But another thing that can have an impact, not so much on on laws, but on rules. One of the things that the BLM wants to do right now is that they want to change the way they do resource planning. They're calling it Planning 2.0, which I don't think has made it catchy. But anyway, what it all boils down to, and I did a story about it, if you're curious, you can read it online. But what the BLM wants to do is it wants all different kinds of people to come in early and often and give their views on what should happen to the BLM lands in their area, or even write letters and tell them what should happen with BLM lands that aren't in their area. And what has happened in reaction to that is there are a number of counties across the West that are very upset about this idea. They think that the counties should be able to have say, pretty much entirely control what happens in BLM lands, but they really want to be able to have a say. There's a in the FLIPMA, I can never remember what that stands for. Anyway, but in FLIPMA, they give the counties a role in the BLM is supposed to coordinate with counties. So what does that mean, coordinate? I guess it's in the eye of the beholder. BLM thinks it means basically talk to them about it, and the counties think, and some counties are pushing for it to mean something much more, that the counties get control. And I think that this is kind of an offshoot of the Sagebrush Rebellion. And in Colorado, it's Garfield County is the county that's been really pushing this. And they don't want BLM to change its planning process because they think that too many interest groups are going to have a say instead of the counties. So that's an example of how.
Yeah, and I think it's important also at this point to talk about that it is a movement that is happening on a county level often, so it's grassroots in nature, and that you do have county commissioners that do vote to put some money into land transfer, for example. So the American Lands Council will take money from counties who are interested in this idea, at least, and they'll, as a sort of membership organization, they'll take money from different counties to fund some of their efforts to promote this idea. But there are also political costs involved because we're starting to see a little bit of backlash, and maybe Jody, you could talk a bit about what has happened to some folks who have kind of been on the front of pushing for land transfers, and then they're seeing some political ramifications, for example. Maybe Idaho?
Yeah, there has been, you know, a lot of politicians, especially at the county commissioner level and at lower levels, that have really been pushing for land transfers. And we've seen some of those politicians get voted out of office pretty recently. There were a couple in Oregon. There's a county commissioner, I think, and a judge in Oregon that had been very strongly supportive of the Malheur occupation and the movement to transfer federal lands. And they lost pretty badly in their elections. There have also been a couple in Idaho that have gone down. And then we'll see, you know, this fall it'll be really interesting to see, because that's, you know, when there, you know, all the House seats are up for grabs, some Senate seats, and there's a lot of congressional leaders that have been very adamant about public lands. And most notably, Rob Bishop of Utah has been one of the most vocal and has really pushed for getting those lands, you know, trying to lead a movement to get lands returned back to states, which is, you know, again, kind of a misnomer. They were never really the states to begin with. And just to kind of give a little bit of an overview of where things are at in different states, Utah really is the front runner at this point in terms of the, you know, get the public lands out of the hands of the federal government movement. And it's kind of ironic because at the same time they are running a TV ad that's the Road to Mighty, touting the 5 national parks that are within Utah. And at the same time they've set aside $14 million to sue the federal government to have state control over other lands. Not national parks, but other federal lands within their boundaries. And Utah's own general counsel has looked at that and said it has a high probability of being found unconstitutional. So it doesn't seem like it's going to go anywhere, but it's not preventing them from trying, certainly. And then we've kind of got a mixed bag other places in the West. You know, Colorado and New Mexico both recently passed public lands day kind of resolutions, you know, expressing support at a very general level at the gubernatorial level for public lands. Nine counties in Colorado have passed resolutions against land transfers. Three have passed them in support. Arizona, they've vetoed some bills to force transfers, but they've did establish a task force to study. One of the counties in Arizona just passed a resolution opposing Idaho, Wyoming. We mentioned Idaho earlier. They're still trying to kind of push that, although, you know, some politicians in Idaho have found that that is not necessarily a good formula for getting reelected. And they've also done an analysis of how much it would, I'm not sure I'm holding this in the right place. They've also done an analysis of where, how much it would cost the states if they actually were to gain control of public lands. And in most of the scenarios, you know, 8 out of 10 in the analysis they did in Idaho, they would cost the state tens of millions annually. You know, there's just tremendous costs involved in managing public lands that it doesn't seem like the proponents of public land transfers have necessarily really thought through those things or have really proposed a plan for dealing with those. There's the cost of firefighting alone, which in some states can far surpass that state's police and law enforcement budget. So there's a really high cost. Utah wound up doing an analysis of the costs of taking over public lands, and they figured that the federal government is spending $247,000 a year to maintain Utah's public lands, that Utah would then have that price tag plus another $23 million to make up for federal payments that are given to counties to make up for the fact that they have a lot of federal land. It's a program called PILT, Insecure Rural Schools. If that revenue was lost, I mean, that's a lot of money each year. And then if the state tries to make up that amount of money going to counties formerly from the federal government, then that's even further pressure to develop those lands and figure out how to get a higher economic return from them.
So we should also say that most of what we're talking about is an idea of who should have say over their land. And this is a movement where people want more local control and outside of the federal government's hands. So there's a flip side, because if you don't want the BLM to develop oil and gas near where you live, you're in this camp, in a way. And so there's like a really interesting twist here, because it's really hard to have it both ways. It's in a way, when you start to think about what folks are asking for local control, there's a way to be sympathetic to this, because it is people who see federal government oversight as not in its best interest. And I think we can all sympathize with that in a way. So there's some interesting layers to this. Jonathan, maybe you could tease out a little bit more some of the implications for local control for folks that aren't necessarily sagebrush rebels, some of the issues that people are facing maybe around here or Colorado or Utah.
Well, I mean, here, you know, you've got your Thompson Divide issue where there's oil and gas leasing that's going on, and the county, Pitkin County, is actually trying to stop it, you know, and spending resources to stop it. And so in a way, they want to have more say in what the BLM does, just like some of these Sagebrush Rebellion counties do as well. I do think there's a little bit of a difference, though. I think that, you know, it's for the counties to say, you know, we want to have some kind of say, we want to be part of this greater decision-making process, is different than what a lot of these Utah counties and stuff are asking for. I mean, obviously, they're asking for a state, you know, transfer of land, actually, so that they have total control. But I don't think that they would settle to have just some control, you know? I mean, I think that they might say, Phil Lyman in San Juan County, as I talked about before, he says, you know, the BLM's okay as long as they basically do what we tell them to do. So they're never going to be satisfied with local control. So I think there is a difference. Whereas I think Pitkin County if, you know, if they felt like they just had some say in what happens in their backyard, that would probably satisfy them a little bit. So there is this difference, you know, and I think also there's a difference, there's different, when you talk about like, okay, we want to give more local control over BLM decision making, you know, what are you talking about? Are you talking about the county government? Are you talking about special interest groups? Are you talking about industry? Are you talking about, you know, who? What does that mean when you talk about local control? So I think there's a lot of nuance and a lot of subtleties there for sure.
That's right, I wanted to be sympathetic for a moment.
Right.
So generally that's where we're looking at High Country News, that's where we're seeing some of these things move. I think I would like to open it up to questions. There are so many different facets of this issue, it's hard to sort of talk about them all at once and like in unidirectionally. So yeah, I want to remind you that there is, we are still live on Aspen Public Radio, so if you could come up and ask your question to the microphone. We'll definitely be doing this for the next 15 minutes. Listeners of Aspen Public Radio can also tweet in questions if they have, and we'll get those questions answered where we can, and we'll keep going as long as we need to get everyone's questions answered. Just listeners may not get all of that, but that's okay. Yes, sir.
Could we learn a bit more from you about the role of county sheriffs and other local law enforcement who must have some conflicting feelings about all this?
Sure, yeah. So county sheriffs are an interesting, it's an interesting office because they're law enforcement officials like a chief of police or anybody else, except that they're elected. So they occupy this kind of strange place. They don't answer to anybody except the voters. So whereas the chief of police, the town board, you know, can come and fire him, or the town administrator or whatever, that's not the case with the sheriff. Sheriff can do all kinds of crazy stuff, and the only way really you can get rid of him is by having a recall election, okay? So I'm just saying that to say that a county sheriff has a lot of power. There is a movement that they call the Constitutional Sheriff Movement, which is a strange name since sheriffs are not mentioned anywhere in the U.S. Constitution. They are mentioned in some state constitutions, and other ones they're created by statute. But and this movement is led mostly by this guy, Richard Mack, who goes way back in the whole patriot movements and that sort of thing, and the Tea Party movement. And his belief is that the sheriff is the ultimate law enforcement authority. In his own county or her own county, the sheriff can basically do whatever the heck he or she wants. And if the belief there is that if even the President of the United States came into the county, the sheriff is at a higher level in that county. And this, so, you know, that's sort of a procedural thing, I guess, but that also, Richard Mack and these constitutional sheriffs typically are anti-federal to some extent. They are, many of them in the West, in the rural West, are also basically sagebrush rebels. And so they go out and instead of being sort of impartial enforcers of the law, they bring their politics into it. And they're not shy about it at all, a lot of them. I mean, there have been conferences and panel discussions where these guys will sit up there and just hammer on environmental regulations on the federal government, and to the point that they threaten to arrest federal officers who try to, say, close a road, a Forest Service road. So saying, and that's happened around here. In a town called Pitkin, which is actually in Gunnison County, a few years ago, there was an incident where this Forest Service wanted to close a road because of impacts. And the sheriff basically led a group of people, a posse, if you will, to go and cut the locks and open the gate back up, you know, and had a showdown with the Forest Service. But in Utah, it happens all the time at a very high level. When Lyman did his Recapture Canyon protest, the sheriff went down and said he was keeping the peace, but if you were there, it really looked like he was protecting the protesters. That really his job there was to make sure that the BLM didn't come in and mess things up. Or that environmental protesters, there was talk about counter protests. by various environmental groups, but they backed off when they heard that the sheriff was going to be down there, and they knew the sheriff's political views were very anti-environmental regulation and were in favor of him. So it can be a huge influence because it's widespread. In Colorado, we saw the biggest thing we saw here was not a Sagebrush Rebel thing, but it had to do with when gun control measures were passed in 2013. Nearly all the sheriffs, I think 54 of 64 county sheriffs in Colorado, sued or basically signed a petition saying that they wanted those gun control measures scrapped.
Elizabeth.
Just to add to your sheriff's talk, I found it fascinating when I was speaking with Bob Abbey, who was the head of the BLM, and before that he was the state director in Nevada of the BLM. So he had dealt with the Bundys for a very long time, and before the Oregon refuge and before the standoff. And he talked to me about how he felt that the failure of the federal government to crack down on the lawless grazing of the Bundys for so many years was part of why we had this armed standoff in the Oregon refuge. And he acknowledged that it was very hard for him to do anything about it. That they didn't want to confront the Bundys because they were worried that there would be violence, and he was very aware of that for many years. And to bring it back to the sheriff's incident, he said that they had to get some kind of a consensus to move on the Bundys. And the consensus involved, of course, the BLM officials, but it also involved the Justice Department, and it also involved the local sheriffs. And this is his view, and I didn't completely report this out on all angles, but at a point where they were just about ready to go forward, the local sheriff said that the court orders were too old, and he wanted a fresher court order before they moved ahead. And so then it took a couple more years to get a fresher court order. And finally it was 2012, and at that point Bob Abbey left the BLM, and as he said, things were handled very badly in 2014. But I if that's true, that the sheriff basically put his heels in and said, you know, look, I don't want to move forward until we have a court order. So that somehow seems impossible. How could it be that the federal government wouldn't do anything for so many years? And if you go through kind of chronologically and see how it happened, it has a lot to do with the local sheriff.
Yeah, I think the local sheriff question is a great one, because the elected nature of their jobs. It's also interesting, we sort of reported on constitutional sheriffs, and sheriffs can have a very long run because the only person who's going to run against a sheriff is his deputy. So the stakes are a little high if you want to run against your boss. So once a sheriff does come into power, you have an elected official that can stay in power for quite a long time and has a lot of say in rural environments and in these communities. So we'll take another question. Or no, yeah, okay. I thought you were coming to the microphone.
Yeah, so something interesting you just mentioned about the sheriffs is their elected nature. They are elected officials. And a lot of folks, in the Forest Service who are critical, and in the BLM, who are critical in making decisions are not necessarily elected officials. And I think there's a lot of folks in these local movements that might be worried that they're not being heard in a system that doesn't have elected officials, where they're submitting complaints and maybe concerns to officials that were never, they never had a say in getting to that position. And so if we're talking about the future of public lands here, is there a way that democracy or maybe elections can enter this system to get, if we're talking about counties having a say, is this a viable option?
Well, I mean, I would say that, often when we're reporting about anti-federal stuff, you end up reporting on anti-bureaucracy rage, which we all understand. We can all feel that. But in a way, there is an elected way. The Bureau of Land Management is governed by the Department of Interior, which has a secretary who's a nominee of a president. So it's slow and it's tangled up, but it's in there, and I don't know if there would be a more direct way to sort of, believe me, everyone wants to untangle the federal bureaucracy that is at the heart of a lot of problems. I don't know that anyone's quite got that figured out, but I wouldn't necessarily say that there's no democracy involved in that. It's just quite diffuse, I guess. But at a county level, certainly there's like much more say, and I guess that's sort of with your county commissioners or something like that is where you would have your say in some of these issues. And heard, I think maybe Elizabeth, you could speak a little bit about that. Like how is the BLM in their planning or whatever? They're trying to make this more democratic in a way, or giving people a way to have their say, right?
The BLM and the Forest Service are both moving in that direction to try to have a lot more opportunities for people to weigh in on the planning process. Just exactly what you're saying. You're right, the guy who you're talking to wasn't elected by the local people, but at least that person, part of his job or her job is to sit there and listen and try to figure out what do the local people want? How can we find a way, to all get along? Are there ways to compromise? Are there ways to let snowmobilers have this slope and cross-country skiers have that slope? That's because they're under this multiple use mandate, which does come from Congress, and Congress was elected, so it is part of the democracy, our democratic system. But it will see if that change really happens, and that this change that I was talking about called BLM 2.0, it's the rulemaking isn't finished yet. And they expect to be finished relatively soon during President Obama's administration, but it's late enough that it's pretty easy for the next president to put it on hold or to kick it out. It's hard to know what President Trump's ideas would be about BLM 2.0, probably not exactly the same as the group in now.
I'm going to take just a second here to check in with our friends at Aspen Public Radio. Do we have any tweets or any questions from listeners? Okay, I'm going to take just a second here and once again thank our sponsors, which that's BF Foundation, Conundrum Catering, Wilderness Workshop, Fish Trap, Colorado Wild Public Lands, Element, The Soper Sun, and New Belgium Brewery. So if we do run out of time here on the live feed for Aspen Public Radio, we're going to keep the questions going here, but we do have another question here.
Quickly, I just want to point out that there have been times also when the U.S., the DOE and the DOD, the Department of Energy and the Department of Defense, also have had run-ins with local people. And that's when we progressives run to the local sagebrush rebels to engage them in those fights. And that's when you get a sense of the frustration of trying to deal with a federal government that isn't interested in listening to the little guys who live on the land that they're having an impact on. So I think that there are some people who can relate to the fact that we are dealing with people who are not elected and who have a huge impact on the lives and the lands in the West. So there is another perspective that can be seen.
I think that's exactly right. And I do think that question about that's really at the roots of the Sagebrush Rebellion is this question of control and having some kind of say in what goes on in your backyard. And it goes both ways, you know. And one thing I forgot to mention with the first Sagebrush Rebellion is that one of the impetuses of it was the MX missile. They wanted to put MX missile silos across the West, you know, and a lot of ranchers didn't want that. A lot of progressives didn't want it either. And at the same time that was happening, the West was being sort of set aside by Jimmy Carter as being sort of the sacrifice zone in our quest for energy independence with big coal mines and oil and gas drilling and that sort of thing. And so there are a lot of progressives who felt like here in the West, we don't have a very big say. You know, and we don't, yeah, sure, there's this democracy, but our congressperson doesn't have much power, and that, you know, that's we're getting stomped on by the guys on the East Coast in the cities. And so I do think that that sense is there, and it's very real, and it's very important to acknowledge, for sure.
Thank you so much. My name is Rachel Richards. I'm a Picken County Commissioner, and I really want to thank High Country News for the coverage of this issue. You've been one of the only real media sources following it and bringing it to light. I've been watching the movement grow for about the 9.5 years I've been in office. I serve on the Public Lands Steering Committee of the National Association of Counties, and I'd like to tell you that it's within the platform of the Public Lands Steering Committee of the National Association of Counties to support a governor if he would like the land back to that governor. And so I, with others, put in a minority statement, but it really didn't get that far. And you just don't have that much attention being paid to the issue by Eastern counties, thinking in terms of that they may be trading off their children's legacy and the legacy of the whole American West. I'd just like to kind of add a little, if I may. The comments you made are very true about secondary effects. These same folks would like to reform to meaninglessness the Endangered Species Act. They would like to roll back the Clean Air Act. They would like to eliminate the Antiquities Act, where a president can nominate any lands. The fight this year that stalled out the Land and Water Conservation Fund reauthorization, and is only supported with kind of a memo to say only if there's no new net gain in public lands is the only way in which we'd endorse this. And I think what you're also seeing kind of roll out this time that's a little different is really the industrial and corporate money behind the scenes through one group to another. And they do morph forms. And I've seen this at several of the forums I'm in, where it's like, well, maybe that whole transfer movement's going to be a little too much. You know, maybe that's too much for people to swallow. We have to promote the idea of charter forest, where we will get to manage it and make all the decisions, but we'll still get federal subsidy to do so. You know, and so you have a lot of kind of crazy ideas, and you have, I will agree in part with the woman who spoke before, a lot of very good-meaning people who are maybe salt of the earth who say, you'll still have your same hunting grounds, and you'll still have your same bike trails, and you'll still have your same grazing rights. We just have to get these properties on the tax rolls.
There's a lot to this. There's a lot to discuss. We're going to keep this discussion going, but right now we want to say thank you to Aspen Public Radio, and thanks everyone here tonight. If you want to learn more about these issues and you're out there, you want to hear this, the remainder of this, I think we'll keep going, but you can go to hcn.org, find out more about this and make comments there. Go ahead.
And just really briefly to finish, we just came from the Colorado Counties, Inc. Summer Conference over in Steamboat this last Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. And on behalf of Picken County, I introduced a resolution opposing the transfer of federal public lands to the states. And we ended up with 14 counties voting in favor of the resolution to oppose, 5 counties abstaining, and 25 counties voting against it. So 25 counties in Colorado are open to the idea or actively supporting it, as you've said. And I think it was Michael Kinsley from RNI who first used the expression with me, what you have is red counties and blue cities. So across the West, you have urban populations that are you kidding me? Why would you do that? And then you have very red counties, maybe with very small populations, but a lot of commissioners. And you know, at the end of the day, I really appreciate your support in trying to move this issue forward to public awareness. It seems like the big environmental groups have just thought, oh, it's just that old sagebrush rebellion again. And it's different this time. Thank you.
So you're saying that 25... So 25 counties in Colorado would be in favor of transferring land?
They voted against a resolution of opposition.
Wow. That's really interesting. That's a surprise to me. That's quite a high number. You know, I think some of this we touched on a little bit, which is the development of energy resources. There's a lot of incentive to, you know, push for a transfer of a certain amount of land out of federal control and into then state control. And then likely what you would see in some of these cases is then easier development, oil and gas. So states already do have some control of bits of land. And one of the things that we look into at High Country News is how those bits of land are being treated versus how sort of, or managed versus how federal lands are being managed. And there is often a difference. There is more oversight or red tape or whatever you want to call it for federal land. But that is a surprising number. more questions? Yeah.
In light of Rachel's comments that she's just made, that this is a movement that is gaining traction and people are listening to its thoughts and ideas, how do we raise this to more of a national dialogue? This is a really hot button issue here in the West because we all live and work and play in the public lands. If you talk to someone from Baltimore, Maryland, or New Jersey, they don't know what public lands are. This seems really arcane and bizarre, and it doesn't really affect them. So how do we make this a national issue?
Well, that's interesting because we generally think of it as a local issue at the county level where sort of county elections could have the most influence over this. So if your county commissioners don't support land transfer, you know, that's one thing. But I don't know how it would move into a national conversation until something happens like the Bundy standoff or the...
We need the consent of Congress to make this happen.
Elizabeth?
Well, actually, the transfer movement needs the consent of Congress to transfer the lands. You can have a lot of counties wanting the transfer of lands. That doesn't give them the lands. That's their viewpoint. But the federal government would have to go along with it. At least that's what the most of the constitutional scholars say. So from that standpoint, it creates this division and this angst at the local level, and and a lot of energy is put into it. But I sometimes wonder from my position in Washington, D.C., of why so much energy is put into this if there's not some success. Where's the success? Where's the example of the place where they managed to make it happen?
Right. I don't know if it needs to be successful per se, but it can excite an electoral base, I think. So I think there's some, I don't know, it feels like it could be something inside of, it's a way to speak to rural Westerners and bring them under the umbrella of certain agendas, I guess.
But you would think that you'd have to eventually have a success.
Really? Do you know any Chicago Cubs fans?
I do, actually. I'm from Chicago, originally.
Yeah.
Can you all hear me?
Yeah, I'd like to bring up a local issue. So recently the USGS came out with these new estimates here locally about the oil and gas potential in the Mancos Shale. A huge departure from their previous estimates, which were taken in 2003, which estimated 1.6 trillion cubic feet of oil and gas. That's up now to 66 trillion. So I want to tap back into that idea of sacrificial lands in the West as this abundant land for resource management, these bridge fuels, departure from coal. Does this type of potential have the ability to derail something like BLM 2.0?
So the question is that if we, for example, find here that there is much more natural gas than originally thought, does that kind of pressure to develop that energy source derail efforts such as the BLM is taking to get all these parties at the table? So this...
Well, I think that you're pointing to a big weakness of this Planning 2.0 idea, which is... the idea that getting people together and having them talk will make everybody get along and come to some kind of consensus. And people do come to consensus sometimes. Usually it's when there's a big outside threat that forces them to come to consensus. Although I some people disagree with this idea that there's a consensus, but there is a consensus in the Yakima Basin on a plan to move forward to share the water and to deal with water systems in Washington State. And one of the reasons that there is that consensus and the state approved it, and now the federal government, at least the Senate, has approved it, is that everybody's scared by climate change because there's not as much water, and so everybody needs water. The fish need water, and the farmers need water, and that scares them into consensus. But for a situation like this, where the oil companies really want the land and the recreation people really want to keep it not drilled, I don't know where's the consensus in that. And so I think it is the weakness of 2.0, the idea that BLM has, that we'll all get together and we'll come to a conclusion. Consensus isn't always possible.
Let me exercise a little bit of democracy here. We can keep going and talk for a little while longer and take some more questions, or we can break from here and go ahead into the reception part of the evening. So maybe a show of hands, who wants to stay in here, ask more questions, and talk some more? Okay, we'll take one question from the man with the fast hand. Oh wait, another question here.
This is Aspen Public Radio. I'm Allison Bechtesh. You've been listening to a live panel discussion on the fate of our public lands from the Rocky Mountain Institute in Basalt, hosted by High Country News. We now join Invisibilia, already in progress. Thanks for tuning in.